So I'm very pleased to see you here tonight. It's a great honor to have our four panelists, our four interviewees and interviewers, all of you are both, here on the occasion of the Kippenberger exhibition, The Problem Perspective. And as you may have read in the Education Department's little blurb, the format of this evening was inspired by the installation in the atrium, The Happy Ending of Franz Kafka's America, a piece that Kippenberger first created in 1994 and that has had various incarnations in the years since then, but at the moment happily living in our atrium and for the first time able to be seen from some 60 feet above itself, which is one of the great pleasures, and looking quite strange in this slide taken from the sixth floor of the museum. But it's a central piece for Kippenberger. It's been seen before in America a couple of times, as well as this show, at the Renaissance Society in Chicago and at the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh during one of the Carnegie Internationals. But it's sort of amazing to me and to those people who have seen it in previous showings that with each presentation, in a way, its mystery is not solved. It doesn't become any more resolved as a kind of provocative piece that is so much about Kippenberger's work as a whole, kind of microcosm of his work in toto, but also so prescient and continuing to be so prescient with each passing year of the work that gets created now. So we wanted to sort of give a nod to Kafka's America in particular, with our setup that acknowledges the whole spirit of this piece as interchange between two people, always with a table, some kind of hand-me-down table or found table or made table or famous table, surrounded by two unmatching chairs, which we have. And I see the Education Department knows that my favorite chairs in the installation are the lifeguard stands, so they have done as well as they can to approximate that for me. And what the format of the evening will be is really two conversations between the ladies and the gentlemen, although there's no meaning to that in regard to Kippenberger's piece. And then, as well as them talking to each other and me talking to both pairs, we then want to leave plenty of time to open it up to the audience, all of you who could have qualified for jobs as actors in the Nature Theater of Oklahoma, and basically just get to know Kippenberger a little more, those of you who already knew him somewhat, or for those of you who, you know, were even too young to have considered having come in contact with him, or just didn't for any other reason. And one of the kind of provocative sides of this whole topic of discussion in Kippenberger's case, much more than in terms of other artists, I think, is the degree to which Kippenberger as a person, for many people, dominated Kippenberger as an artist, let alone the works of art that Kippenberger made. And here we are 12 years after his death. Has that gone away to some extent just because of that distance of time? Has it lessened the work? Has it made the work greater? It's a loaded question, knowing Kippenberger, and hopefully tonight we will explore that to some profit and with much pleasure. I'm Ann Temkin, by the way, the Marie-Josée and Henry Kravis Chief Curator of Painting and Sculpture, and I'm going to give my one-minute introductions of all of our panelists, starting with Rachel Harrison on my far right. She's an artist, as I think everybody here probably knows, who has been very much on view in recent times, but I will announce has upcoming solo shows at the Hessel Museum at Bard College and at Porticus in Frankfurt. Recent solo exhibitions include Sunny Side Up at the Gallery Meyer Kiner in Vienna and If I Did It at Greenough Tolly here in New York in 2007. She's exhibited in countless group shows around the world, but closer to home in 2007, this museum acquired her sculpture, Alexander the Great, and the series of 57 photographs called Voyage of the Beagle, both of which have been on Recent View. Jana Vikos is an art critic and art historian, very active in the kind of Kippenbergerian literature. She's on the faculty of the SVA, the School of Visual Arts, and the MFA program at NYU. She is the recipient of the Frank Jewett Mather Award, which the College Art Association gives for distinction in arts criticism. Her special interest in Kippenberger in catalogs published for Metro Pictures has focused on the late work, and in particular the paintings that Pablo couldn't paint anymore of Jacqueline Picasso on view upstairs. To my left, artist Jeff Koons, here very generously, like Rachel, speaking not on their own work, but on, or you will speak somewhat on your own work, I hope, but on the work of a peer, in Rachel's case, somewhat an older artist, in Jeff's case, a precise peer, and someone who, during the work being, shall we say, developed in the mid-1980s, was often compared by the press to Kippenberger as a kind of counterpoint between Germany and America. Two of his recent installations include the Split Rocker, the floral sculpture that was on exhibit along with many others at the Palace of Versailles last summer, and also last summer, the three large celebration sculptures on the roof of the Metropolitan Museum. Finally, Friedrich Petzl, on the far left, my far left, owner of the Friedrich Petzl Gallery here in New York since the early 90s, but prior to that, director of Metro Pictures, and to that of Galerie Gisela Capitan in Cologne, and Gisela Capitan's gallery where Kippenberger showed all of that time. In October, he and Gisela opened a new gallery in Berlin called Capitan Petzl, where there will be a show of Kippenberger's work starting next month, I believe. And for Friedrich also, like Rachel, part of a younger generation, but for whom Kippenberger had a very direct presence during his years becoming a dealer. So we have a nice range of expertise and perspective, and we're going to start off, ladies before gentlemen, and I think we have not set Rachel as the interviewer, as the job seeker, and Jan as the job giver. But we are going to start off asking Jan to ask Rachel a few questions from the point of view of an art critic speaking to an artist.
This has been thoroughly rehearsed.
In the last 5 seconds.
Rachel and I made a point not to talk about any of these subjects prior to this moment. And in the spirit of that, I would like to turn to address you a little bit more comfortably. Rachel, I've never told you this, but
I can't wait.
Just having a little fun. I'm very interested to hear, Friedrich, about your perception of the reception of Martin's work and behaviors in Germany. But my experience in the 80s, in knowing Martin, it was largely from the perspective of being in New York. And I have to say that, you know, before his death and with the inevitable canonization that takes place and the, you know, kind of careful suturing of all the raw edges of the work into something cohesive, there was, I think, some hesitancy or doubt on the part of many to fully accept the aesthetic credibility of the work. Because there was so much casualness, there was a certain attitude that manifested in the work sometimes. I could give you an example of the one of his crushed subway entrances, one of his subway entrances that was destined to be shown at Metro Pictures, and it didn't fit into the gallery. So he instructed the gallery simply to crush it sufficiently so that it would fit through the doors of the gallery, and hence it became the crushed subway entrance. But I learned something from Martin very particular one time, and it was in the old Metro Pictures in Soho, and there was an installation of his paintings. And a lot of the paintings, again, you know, people weren't terribly sure about this notion of bad painting and bad sculpture in America. And so we were waiting for everyone to get ready to go to lunch. And I began to observe Martin, just in this kind of casual, offhanded way he had, of going around the exhibition and being very precise about how each painting hung on the wall and, you know, making sure that everything was, in effect, perfect. And it really showed me something. It showed me something about a relationship that I think informs a lot of the work between precision and then something that's really casual and offhanded. And in preparation for tonight, I was thinking about your participation and about your work and maybe certain relationships that exist between materials and installation practices and a certain eclecticism that informs your work that I think is comparable with aspects of his. And I wonder if you have any comments to make about that, the apparent casualness of an installation, and yet perhaps what underwrites that casualness as something precise or really considered that isn't at all apparent at first. Does any of that ever happen for you in your installations or your practice or your selection of materials?
Well, because we talked at length about the fact that we would just talk about Kippenberger tonight, I'm going to address the first part, which is the appearance of casualness. Mm-hmm. Because I think in terms of the participants here tonight, I'm the one who's probably seen the least of his work in the real, because I came to it so late, since I've been based in New York my whole life and made so few trips to Germany while mm-hmm. he was alive. I don't view his work as casual. I've always viewed it as being definitely energetic and with a very specific kind of attitude and a communication of a certain kind of expression and also romance, I believe in, that, like this, for example, this studio. There's nothing casual about the placement of the bag out the window with the butter and the vodka, you know, which is also to like a New Yorker kind of like, oh, in Germany they really know how to live, or wherever this went. You know, it's like, you know, you have your studio and you put the vodka and the butter out the window. You don't need a little portable refrigerator. You know, mm-hmm. it just all takes care of itself. And those kinds of details in his work have always jumped out at me. The kind of specificity that you see in Peter, in terms of the fonts on the signs and that there's this one with a pole on this little the angle of that pole, I think you could probably calculate to a specific degree. Mm-hmm. So I've never seen a casualness in his work. There are things that could be misread that way, because given the appearance, it doesn't look like other artwork, and it certainly looks more loose. Mm-hmm. But that's very different than not being. That's very different than being casual, I think. The looseness is different than being casual.
Okay
for Rachel and Jan?
Oh, sorry.
In the back of the room?
Yes? Yes.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I think what I'm implying as casualness, I think, is, you know, very close to a notion of looseness as you're using that.
And then in that looseness, it would also be probably his intention, and I didn't know him. I never met him, didn't know him at all. To communicate a certain kind of spirit of activity as an artist, the way an artist participates, which, and I think Anne wants to talk about this later too, in terms of how he lived his life, that the gestures and the actions were so wrapped up in, you know, going to Documento and installing his own lamppost, or, you know, mm-hmm. the Paris bar, or mm-hmm. the island in Greece where he had MoMAs, like these gestures that were, you know, within the art world, but very much his own. And, mm-hmm. and took his own energy into the action of presenting the objects, and were the objects always even that important? Because it was more the action of it. So there's a kind of actionism, I think, in his work. I would say that's in opposition to casualness, because in casualness also implies a certain indifference, and I don't feel that there's indifference in his work. Even if it's loose, it's too angry. It's got too much emotion.
Yeah, I think it does definitely. That emotion ricochets through so much of the work, and yeah. I definitely agree with you that the 24/7 attitude that informed his practice was, you know, one of the more legendary aspects of his appearances as an artist. I remember many occasions when he came to New York with groups of students, and the point was certainly not to go around to the galleries or to the museums or to kind of cover art exhibitions, but rather to instruct on the right bars and the right restaurants and, you know, basically how to participate in the scene.
Right. Because the life of the artist is the work, right? I mean, and I think that's something that a lot of people get from Kippenberger, that it all the activity, all the space in between, all the action, and all the kind of, you know, what bar to go to, the social aspect of it, the construction of this was very, seems so rooted in the work. And that's why The Happy End of Franz Kafka is so interesting in terms of this kind of completely artificial factory of the interview, but also the conversation.
Yeah.
Because it's so blank, right? All the tables are empty. And, I mean, they aren't empty because there are a couple artifacts here and there, but it's creating a very blank space to project onto. So it's a space without people, but he's asking for the people.
There was another aspect. I mean, we can just keep talking over here until...
I'll tell you what.
And what's the plan? What are we doing?
Oh, okay. The plan is a dialogue over here for 15 minutes, dialogue over here for 15 minutes, dialogue among all of us for 15 minutes.
Okay. All right. So are you clocking us?
I am.
Okay.
As I'm sure many volunteers out in the audience are as well.
That's good.
Well, speaking about the personality of Martin and the living the life that was so much a part of the way he manifested as an artist and how that manifests in the work, and we haven't really talked about this again, but something that I feel is so significant in the work occurs in the late portraiture. Portraiture really is a function of his practice throughout the work, and we see a lot of goofy images of the artist. We see a lot of spoofing and clowning around that seems to mirror, to a certain extent, a streak of rambunctiousness, bad boy behavior, antics. You know, there is like a kind of thrill a minute that is the potential of the work to deliver, and certainly, I think, kind of reverberated in the course of his everyday life and practice. My impressions of the late works, however, which really open themselves to the stark confrontation with death, the Medusa references the series of etchings in which he poses in the postures of the figures on Jericho's raft of the Medusa, totally took my breath away when I first saw them, and are compatible with an extended series of works that seem almost out of character with the more jovial, genial, clowning around type of attitude that one often encounters in the work. I'm just curious, you're coming to the work kind of after the fact, but you've gone through and seen the show, if you had any thoughts about the late works or, again, this kind of manifestation of persona that's so pervasive in the work.
Yeah, and I mean, specifically in those late paintings, him confronting his own death, which I think they're brutal and they communicate that. One of the things I was thinking about when you were talking was the first time, and also a lot of his works, I was very aware of through books, even if I hadn't seen the actual things and what catalogs I could get. The first time I saw an image of one of the palette sculptures, I knew nothing about it. So for those of you who don't know them, they're just, you know, wood palettes on pedestals, and they're made in series, and they have... And I don't think I even knew the title at first, and I was just struck by the image, and I thought it was very raw, and I thought, you know, and pretty bold and pretty gutsy and very specific, and I didn't know anything about it. And so later, when I read that his mother had been killed by a palette, that really struck me. So in terms of also him confronting death and the kind of humor and tragedy that I feel is mixed throughout all of his works, not just the late ones, that maybe it's harder to get at. And I mean, the late portraits that you're discussing and that you've written about so well, are That's definitely where it's the most direct. But I'm wondering if it isn't always there. If because of his mother's death, there isn't sadness and, mm-hmm. and a lot of pain and mm-hmm. a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And those palette sculptures, because so much of his sculpture practice to me deals with architecture. It's the happy end of Franz Kafka, dealing with design and taste, artifacts, things like that. But mm-hmm. it also describes spaces. And all the kinds of jokes he made also in the paintings about architecture, is not what you would necessarily think of when you think of death. But I think if you think of them as memorials and you think of them as monuments and you start to look at them in that direction, the kind of cemetery aspect.
Yeah,
of all these
one wonders how pervasive that is in the work.
You can sort of force any argument onto an artwork, though, right? So we could go look for death
not
everywhere.
Not that we want to do that.
Not that we want to do that. But I do think, and I don't even remember what you asked anymore, that the late works also, because he was never shy to use himself in every way and to use his own failure in every way. So the late work is also a natural kind of mm-hmm. culmination.
That's
of that
a really good observation.
Exploration of the self, right? Mm-hmm. Like I remember reading a piece Diedrich Dietrichson wrote about when he was young, and I don't know, you can tell me where in Germany or where did he put pictures of himself with those captions in the subways?
Oh, Berlin.
It was in Berlin or Cologne.
Six.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And maybe you can talk about that later. I think, that's like, and he was how old, right? So very young, 20s. And
22.
Yeah, right. So there he was, putting these posters of himself with, like, I need a wife. Didn't they say things like that? Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that about death?
Can I just kind of leap across?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Now, that's very optimistic. Friedrich, I'm just kind of curious to hear you chime in on this issue of the perhaps latent contents that, might have been embedded in the work that would have preceded those later works that are so stark in their confrontations with the inevitability of death.
I think, do you hear me? This is working?
Yeah.
Oops, God. I think, if you talk about the late work, especially the Jacqueline Onassis and the Géricault paintings, I even think in the late work he makes comedy of death. There's nothing sacrosanct. He can continue this ad nauseum. There's not a particular sadness, I think, in the work. So I think when you say the comic is excluded from the late work, I don't see that necessarily. It was like you say. It was always there.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and then the absurdity of the comedy. Right?
Absurd. Yeah.
Also that someone could take a palette that might have killed his mother and turn it into a hospital.
Exactly.
Yeah. That there's so much bad humor in this. That right.
There's also something else. On this subject that I'm just thinking about the later years. And it seems almost anachronistic to say that since he died at 44, which, with every passing year seems younger and younger to me. But the idea of his anticipation of that seems to be very pronounced in the later work, because of its inevitability. And in a certain sense, I think there was almost, in retrospect, a kind of bravura to that work and his confrontation of his demise that it runs so against the grain of the, shall we say, the kind of lifestyle that is promoted these days. You have a healthy life, you take care of yourself, you have your 401k, and you've got this, and you've got that, and, everything is sort of arranged in a very neat and tidy way. And I think the way he lived his life, in a certain sense, is reflected in the work,
the intensity, you mean, or?
Well, yes, it's an intensity. It's also a certain determination to be who he was to the very end, even though that was fatal in many respects. When I'm thinking about the alcoholism and the...
But at the same time, it's also kind of an embracement of life, of the way I looked at this. This was probably the most intense character I've ever met in my life so far, at least. And it was not easy to be around sometimes, because even a simple dinner party could turn into some performance of his, or he tried to engage all of us, like 15, 20 people around, the more the better, the more the merrier. But the intensity was sometimes excruciating, so you had to kind of go into a spa like after 3 days or so. But at the same time, it was very life-embracing, I think. I mean, yeah, on the one hand, you see this as a double-edged sword. I mean, if you live that life, yeah, then there's certain consequences, but you would never stop. I remember the days where I had to run around with him during the Metro Pictures years, where I had to run around with 2 six-packs of non-alcoholic beer because he decided not to drink for a while. That was even worse. Because it never stopped. And the only way he stopped was making art. I remember the days also at Metro Pictures where he made drawings in the office of Helena Janelle. You know, hours and hours and hours, no alcohol. I mean, work, 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 work. That was the guide, that was the principle, the guidance. I think it's very life-affirming.
But we did learn so much during the installation, working together with a couple of assistants who had been working with Kippenberger in the 90s. And one of the things that has stuck in my mind that Uli Strojan mentioned was that the need to be around people was so intense that Kippenberger would actually pay assistants just to be with him when everyone else had gone home or when his family was away or even not with those conditions necessarily. You would get paid just to keep him company because the urge for that was so imperative. And that's extreme.
Because and you see it in the work. I mean, the work is about communication. It's about like not, you know, I'm not some solipsistic artist sitting in my studio trying to kind of make a picture how to better this world or so. No, it's about communication. It's always production and communication. That was the key, and that's what I think he loved about your work so much, communication.
Now let's shift. Yeah.
I'm listening to what everybody's been saying and thinking about the work, and of course, you know, Martin's personality was so huge, and he wasn't shy, and so engaged. But I think what's when I look at the work and look at the exhibition, you know, it's amazing people's artists' relationship with their art and what they want to receive from the activity that they're involved with. And in Martin's work, the energy of just creating things. It seems to me, without the ambition until the end, for transcendence. It's to make things to make. Not that piece that you're going to make is going to take you to a higher state, and then you make something, and that takes you to a higher state. It's just to make. But I do feel in the later works, the Wrath of the Medusa and the Jacqueline paintings, there is more a sense of transcendence with relationships, with art history, and that there's a sense of almost a goal where this work could take him.
I had a sense of that in looking at those works as well, although I can appreciate what you're saying, Friedrich, about an element of the comic that informs those works to the very end. But, you know, this strikes me as a great opportunity to ask every question I've ever wanted to ask about Martin Kippenberger's work, and there's a few. So I wonder if anybody up here, or in the audience for that matter, knows about, there's a painting that's in the exhibition that shows a kind of oversized, almost kind of grotesque likeness of himself, and the body is clothed in a floral dress. And I remember seeing photographs that perhaps his wife took of him laid on in the studio, and there he stands in this, you know, fairly elegant gay dress.
Isimiyaki.
Is it Isimiyaki? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I remember in writing about the Jacqueline paintings and at the dinner, I mean, you know, it was like all women. He was managed by women, even though there was like a healthy streak of misogyny that surfaced on occasion, periodically. But perhaps that's a bit of a different story. So I was just very curious about his impersonation, not of Jacqueline, because we kind of understand some of the motives there, but in this photograph with him wearing the dress. Do you know anything about that? Do you, Anne? Is that kind
No, except it seems consistent in a way with with what's present in so many of the self-portraits, of this combination of utter machismo and self-aggrandizement in a way that's absolutely simultaneous with this certain almost self-loathing and absolute self-criticism and, you know, building up all of these mythologies of Picasso and Matisse and Joseph Beuys and Gerhard Richter, and at the absolutely same time, you know, cutting them down. There's, for me, this kind of polarity that's always there. And so in the same way as he can make himself seem like this utterly, male artist with all that goes with that in the cliched way, you know, yeah, then he's there in that dress. Mm-hmm. And it's always ambiguous. It's always very ambiguous.
I never saw cross-dressing.
Yeah.
As, you know, part of the antics or even the fashionability.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's a little bit of a mystery. And then just an observation I had in walking through and looking at this splendid selection of works in the exhibition and just thinking about how Martin found certain things incredibly hilarious or amusing. And some of that memory that I have is attached to the production of works that manifested in some way or another as absurd. So, you know, it caught my eye, the kind of Rust-Oleum colored paint with rolled oats mixed in as part of the covering of structures. And that's like another one of my questions about the oatmeal and perhaps what precipitated that. Because when I saw it, I imagined a certain, you know, kind of laughter that was familiar in terms of making works that were impossible to conserve, or works that in some sense were almost destined to defeat the institution's desire to maintain those works in a certain pristine condition. Do you know anything about the oats, the story of the rolled oats?
The oatmeal, if I recall, it started, I think, in 82 or so, is that right? And I think, if I remember this, the joke was at the time, we rediscovered painting in the early 80s, and there was a book that, I forgot the author right now, that wrote a book, Hunger for Painting, a German author. So Martin used that, hunger for painting. Well, we should make a painting that satisfied this desire. Oatmeal. I mean, it came, sometimes these ideas came out of a very kind of vernacular background. It was a very simple translation from something that was discussed in a bar. Okay, tomorrow we're going to start with oatmeal because we're hungry for pictures.
Yeah. And we've had a lot of questions about the Ford Capri.
Which is a desirable object for a certain middle-class German in the late 70s. That's what everybody wanted to drive. It had also kind of a little bit like an American look to it.
Yeah.
But that's all I remember. I think it's a collaboration with Albert.
Yes.
I think there was the two of, there's a discussion that the two of them had.
With their car and their own wheel. Mm.
I thought a little bit about this cross-dressing also. I remember the years in the 80s where Kippenberg always had the slightly self-deprecating kind of attitude, and he always felt that he was at the periphery, even though Cologne was a center in the 1980s, at least for Europe, in the art market. And there were amazing artists that lived there and still live there. Sigmar Polke, Gerd Richter. But at the same time, he always felt a bit like excluded from the master narrative. So I think this kind of affinity to women practice, even though he probably convoluted a lot of these things and was not very analytic about it, but I think that may have influenced his appreciation for this kind of support structure that women provided him with.
That certainly...
I make this up right now, but... I think there is a certain kind of affinity that he felt there.
I would think that, you know, somebody like Albert Olin and Marcus Olin, a lot of these people were supporting him early on, right? Maybe earlier he had more of this male... support system.
Were you in Cologne much at that time with that?
I started, the first time I was with Martin in Cologne was in 86. And, you know, Martin was, I was in a group show with Max Hetzler. Martin and Max had come to New York to arrange a show at Metro Pictures. And Martin went around the East Village, and he liked a lot of the work that he saw. And so when they went back to Cologne, they organized that there was going to be a group show, and I was one of the artists, along with Chris Wool, John Kessler, Bob Gober. And it was a group of artists, so when we went over, you know, Martin was very embracing. We stayed at the hotel that he was controlling, the Chelsea Hotel, and I guess every room had works by Martin and Albert, and it was a whole... an event happening the hotel. But it was a lot of drinking, a lot of partying, but you just felt a sense of support. It was kind of like, you know, these guys are all right. These American artists are okay. You know, they're going to be nice to have a dialogue with. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. And it would be, you know, just what Frederick was saying, that whatever would happen, it would start to become a work of art. And the next day, you know, Martin would be working on something based on the conversation, or, you know, some funny thing that he picked up.
Let's make a poster. Yeah. You did a poster together.
Yeah. And so he wanted to involve everybody, you know, he wanted everybody that was in his company to get involved.
Yeah, there was a great deal of camaraderie that I think cemented social relations and provoked the production of works and thematics, small and large. But on the subject of camaraderie, and again, I'm going to look to you, Friedrich, just to sort of plumb what knowledge you might have of the subject. A lot of the paintings that, for better or worse, became designated in the 80s as bad painting, and that, you know, would be somewhat compatible with the East Village style and such, I think in a number of those works we can see this, you know, great love for Americana and tourism and, you know, those kinds of almost like leisurely pursuits. But there was also something else there which I always understood as a certain spoof of East German art. And, you know, references to the young socialist or... kind of around the time, you know, the young artist who manipulates garbage, which was perhaps a reference to Mike Kelly. But it seemed as though prior to 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, there was, you know, such a separation between painters in East Germany and what might have been going on in West Germany at the time. And I understood a number of those works, and I wish I could recall titles at the moment, short of hauling out the catalog, which I have with me. I just remembered that there was a certain kind of spoofing of East German painting and the kind of bastardized style of social realism that informed a lot of that work. Did you ever have conversations with him about that, or do you know anything about that?
Not necessarily the East-West divide. I mean, I think he was less interested in this. I think he was more interested in the fact that he was interested in West Germany, how it feels, like 1977, for example. He was not interested in the German history with all the baggage applied to this, but he was very interested in the filmmaker Werner Fassbinder, for example. No, I mean, my connection with Kippenberger came from film, actually, when I was in my early 20s or so, because I loved Fassbinder's movies, and so did he. So he was interested in, like, the Bundesrepublik, you know, this awkward country that came out of this mess in the 1960s and 70s. East-West, not so much, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he never really looked there. I mean, he went there once or twice, but I don't think it was very important to him.
When you were making work at the same time or showing work, I wonder how much the idea of his work as something that would only be for a German audience was present. You know, that was certainly something people had said about Joseph Beuys, for example. Oh, it would never cross the Atlantic. There's just too much meaning and too much political innuendo and too much dependence on background. And that, unlike your work, say, Jeff, where anybody who, you know, knew their cartoon characters or, you know, it was like transparent in this clear, direct American way. Did you have a resistance to his work as something that seemed like more mired in content background?
You know, I always loved Martin's work, and I loved the, you know, it's very aestheticized and very controlled, and if you look at, we were talking about the chance aspects or casual qualities of these things, but the colors are so controlled, and it's so aesthetic, so that really, you know, it's kind of like a physical element that's controlling. But then the engagement of all of these external things, very unclassist work. I mean, it's work for everybody. It wants acceptance. Martin wanted acceptance. And you know, I love that about Martin's work. I lived with one of the self-portraits that's upstairs. When I went through a terrible divorce custody, it was one of the, you know, everything that I owned of my own work went. So I really kept these other artists' work to the end. But I had the large untitled one with the hammer and the sickle and the breasts and the sun, where the he's blue in his underwear, and it was fantastic. But yeah, the ambition was so great. I mean, Martin wanted to participate, and so anybody's work that you come across that wants to participate, I mean, it just does. So I always thought that it was. I probably thought it was participating at a higher level than what it actually was.
You know, there's this great quotation of Picasso's, which is that good artists borrow, but great artists steal. And I think that is a real recommendation for Kippenberger's art. And yeah, I guess, Rachel, I would ask if that was something like that resonated with you, how much his work actually did steal other people's work, whether legitimately, like collaboration on a poster, or completely illegitimately, like without asking, just including in the Peter sculpture something by somebody else without their ever knowing it.
Well, I mean, Richter knew he bought the painting. I mean, I never ever thought about him stealing. I've thought about a lot about artists who've, like artists of my generation who steal from him. I mean, there's so many examples of that. But I've never thought of it as stealing because I think, as Jeff points out, his own ambition is so clearly there all the time, and you feel like it's his work. It never looks like anything but his own, yeah. No matter what it is. If it's a sculpture, if it's a drawing, it's a painting. Yeah. But I want to go back to this question about nationality and the work, because that's something that, you know, especially now we think is being reformed because images are circulating at more rapid speed than art is being made. So we have a place now that. We don't think of it as much as a previous generation. And this idea of cultural translation, I think, is what always makes art interesting. Because, you know, okay, Joseph Beuys, yeah, you can't know anything about his work if you don't know about German history. And that just goes with it hand in hand, you know? And this is true of literature, right? You know, you read a Henry James novel or whatever it might be, you always know the context in which the work is produced. And I really respect the audience for art, and so I really believe that if you're interested in something, you find out more about it. So, like, for myself, not knowing very much about his work, I always understood that, you know, Polka was a big influence, and that he had these peers like Albert Olin, whose work I was interested in, and that, you know, you sort of see the dialogue. So the second question about the stealing, just never thought about it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The first question about the nationality, I thought about it, and I think, well, that's really what's great about art, but then you think so much of his work is portraiture. Which is the most, you know, human and directly communicative form of and traditional form of art in so many ways, which crosses all boundaries, right? To have the image of a person's face in the center of a rectangle is something which is you know, very generous and very communicative in a way that you don't really need to know what this text says. But, you know, if I do encounter one of his exhibitions, like a, you know. I like the one upstairs. I did want to go with a friend who was German so she could translate everything that I didn't already know. And, you know, I'm always curious to understand more about the puns. I mean, I don't know if Friedrich would want to talk about this, but we'd want to put you on the spot as the non-American. But because I think like Duchamp, his play with language is very important.
Yeah.
Like the language that does exist, the text that is included, and then some of the titles. Because I think the way that German translates to English, it's always a little bit off and a little bit strange, and we don't really get it. And the grammar is so different that you have to sort of go through. It always has to be explained in this roundabout way to me.
Yeah.
And that's always interesting in also understanding his work,
yeah,
in terms of the logic and the thinking behind it. Because I do, and we haven't talked much about language tonight, but I've always felt it in his work.
Yeah.
Rachel, I just, as far as work of art that where you have to know something to enjoy that work of art. I think really a great artist puts everything that you need to know in that artwork. And I think Martin did that. And I can look and not understand the phrases in German, but emotionally I'm going to be set up, or it's going to feel these polarities, or I'm going to feel a sense of ease. I'm going to know enough to experience this work on some emotional level, some intellectual level, that I understand it.
I absolutely agree. And I think also great artworks, there are always many layers to them. So there's the thing you first get when you first see it, and there's this thing that might linger later on, and then you might revisit the work and something comes back. And I actually agree with you, and that's why I was speaking earlier about those palettes. I knew nothing about it, but it communicated. I mean, maybe it didn't communicate to everyone, but it communicated something to me that I didn't know and I couldn't have possibly known. And it was so banal as an object. And so there was something that he did. He had that special thing that he knew to really get it in there. And I'm wondering, in terms of process, what you were saying about the oatmeal, like, oh, God, we're hungry, we have to use some oatmeal and put it on the capri or whatever it might be, the chain of... I'm very jealous in how he worked in this very uncensored way, that every idea is a good idea and let's just do it. And that's where the activity of the artwork, being constant, not just in the studio or drawing on the hotel paper or drawing in the bar or drawing in the back of the gallery, but also all the social activity of like, well, let's arrange this and let's get, you know, let's get a free meal at the restaurant in exchange for a painting and let's think of a scam so I can get into Documenta and all the kind of activity and the spaces between the artworks, I think, are so important to understanding the work, you know, and that standing in the corner is a multiple, it's a multiple of six, right? So he's in many places all at once, you know, he's constantly in many corners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's also like one of the fantastic things about the hotel drawings, that they are this complete spoof in a way on how much we invest in literal autobiography, because we see in the exhibition, you know, people saying, oh my God, he was in Tokyo, then he was in Bali, then he was in Austria, then he was in New York, then he was in Kansas. And of course, you expect that because it sets you up for that. But, you know, he had his friends and people who knew him send him these hotel stationery pages from everywhere they went. So certainly a few of those, or many of those, were hotels that he was at. But it was by no means him sitting there at the desk in the hotel using that piece of stationery that he had just taken out of the drawer that would allow someone like me to lovingly figure out where his travels were over this time. It's a complete ruse, and, you know, that's part of the whole setup, I think, that goes with what you're saying. But also the interesting thing to me, thinking of the hotel drawings, of which there are hundreds and hundreds, from an artist's point of view or a dealer's point of view would be very different, this... just the insanity of the prolificness. And, you know, I always think there are two kinds of artists who are either the perfectionists who very slowly release one work at a time out of the studio to total a few a year, and then the ones who are like Picasso, for example, but just like do it all, let other people worry about what's good or what's not good. And obviously Kippenberger was in that latter category.
But maybe with him you can't tell, and that's good. And that's the other thing I get.
Yeah.
Well, there's the invariable editing of the work. I mean, Friedrich, when you said you're showing Martin Kippenberger next month in your gallery in Berlin, you know, it's like, which Martin is going to appear?
Yeah.
I think also, just to go back to something you were saying about the textuality of the work, I would kind of fumble if I tried to say it in German, but there's one work that declares work until all is clear. That was shown at Metro. Arbeit bis alles ist geklärt. Or something similar. Anyway, work until all is clear. Okay, that's a nice modus operandi. And then I think of another painting that where he writes out, in need of a dentist. You know, and that would be one of those situations where perhaps he was in need of a dentist, and that occupied his thoughts that day. So I find it really interesting, the slippery slope of meaning in the work, where some things strike one as profound and have the potential to, you know, register a great deal of, you know, pretty heavyweight meaning. A palate killed his mother. He uses a palate in the work. Well, of course, you know, that's that promises something profound. And yet, at the same time, the viewer is confronted with a kind of stream of consciousness in which, you know, some things have a great deal of import and might, in fact, carry the day in terms of a meaning that extends in time, or as you're saying, Jeff, you know, a work that takes on profound meaning to you in your personal everyday life. And yet other aspects of the work are dumb, intentionally so, yes, but, you know, don't promise any kind of relief in trying to articulate an agenda or a kind of, you know, platform of meaning in the work. You were going to say?
In that respect, it's kind of organized horizontally. There's no kind of hierarchy of more or less important. One of the most amazing shows was in 1986. The German title is Miete, Strom, Gas. And I didn't get it at the time. I was too young. I just entered this gallery system and so on. And then Gisela said, yeah, Miete, Strom, Gas. I mean, artists also have to work for rent, electricity, and gas. So you can't produce a masterpiece every 5 minutes. You have to pay your rent. You have to pay your amenities and so on. So those are the things that I think Martin, that's why he influenced so many of us. It's a very pragmatic thinking. And I guess that was one of the biggest influences, at least to me, now being a dealer. There's some very pragmatic choices that we have to make as an artist, as a dealer, as a curator. But then there were all these, even within that body of work, there are very profound paintings that certainly would pay more than the rent today.
Mm-hmm. Do you have favorites in the show, I want to ask of all of you?
Oh, yeah.
And do you think, I mean, I'm interested, I guess, a little bit how much they're personal favorites and how much you would say this is one of the great Kippenberger works. You know, like, is that...
I think that's what's really under consideration these days. As the... As Martin's personality exists in the work, not his presence, and how, you know, dominating he could be as a figure. But now that he's gone, the sort of willy-nilliness, and I what do I mean by that? I mean that field approach that you're talking about, Friedrich, the horizontality. It's making art every day. Some of it is great, some of it's not great. The point is not to discriminate, but to produce. But here we are now, discriminating and attempting the identification of the really great works as opposed to the works that don't remain in our memory or capture our imagination or whatever the determination might be. I as I told you before, it was wonderful to see those later paintings. I've only seen a few of them, and to see how imposing they are, how dramatic, how complicated, and not at all characterized by the kind of comedy and antics that informed the work of the 80s or the early 90s. That's quite memorable. And as you point out, too, with the hotel portraits, I've never seen so many altogether. So it creates, again, a kind of almost running stream of consciousness of visual thoughts that find their way onto those papers. And yet, you know, there is something that strikes one as tremendously authentic about those works, even though he didn't visit all of those places. It was before inkjet printers. It was before our ability to manufacture those kinds of letterheads and, you know, personalized papers from various hotels. And so, you know, it's so easy to make the assumption that he was protean in the sense that he was everywhere at once. But I really appreciated seeing those. And I think, you know, every time the work is presented, there was a great show within the last year uptown, I forget the gallery, perhaps someone knows it, that was showing all the ephemera, the posters, the artist books, the invitation announcements. I think that, too, gives a great glimpse into the energy this man had to record his life, make self-portraits and anecdotal references to the everyday, the incidental. And in some sense, that paves the way for those late works that are so loaded in ways that I I don't find necessarily some of the earlier works are. They're informed in a different kind of way. Like when you're talking about nationalism, I was thinking how one thing I enjoyed about his work so much was the picture he created of America from a German perspective. So, you know, the many photographs, some of which are included in the show, of his being a tourist. You remember ones where he's holding some kind of fake bomb in front of the World Trade Towers, and another one he's pretending to be a Confederate soldier trying to break out of jail. And it's like American history became so much fun in that work. Yeah. Or, you know, his infatuation with bumper stickers at a particular point in our popular history. You know, at the point he had them manufactured and plastered them all over his paintings, and you know, there was a kind of nonsense, a silly logic that was so pervasive in the work that, of course, we recognize is very rooted historically. And it's something I think about the terrain of German art, not only Polka and Richter and the immediate generation before him, but going all the way back into Dada and a certain kind of appetite, shall we say, for the crude, for the nonsensical, for the spoof, you know, which seemed to be part of his arsenal in a way.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of relationships to Courbet, you know, with the radical quality, the drinking, the you know, defining what the artist's lifestyle can be like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was also thinking of Caravaggio.
Mm-hmm. That way, maybe.
More short-lived. What about work that spoke to you? Go ahead.
It was a piece that was in the MoCA show that isn't here, and I can't remember it clearly. So, but it's photographs of a boy in Brazil and a pair of sunglasses.
Yeah.
Do you know the title of that piece?
I don't know the title.
Yep. I love that piece. And I had never seen it before. Yeah.
I think when I see the Peter installation, the sculptures from 1987, this is the first time I think they ever came together again since the show at Max Hetzler's. It's still drop dead. I think it's one of the real inventions in sculpture. And they're still so irritating. I think I still can't make myself. I mean, they must have influenced to some extent your work.
I can't admit that those are my favorite works because it's too obvious. If I was to say that, that's why I'm going with this. Also, this anecdote about a young boy in Brazil that he befriended.
Right.
And, yeah, but really, to see them in the real after seeing them in books for so many years, certainly I love those works, and also know that you worked closely with his assistants in terms of the arrangements of them. But it's also interesting because if you first encounter that work through books, they're all photographed independently, and it was hard for me to see installation shots. Right? There's so many catalogs and books, and there's, you know, that this is just each sculpture independently. So then when you encounter it in such an arrangement where, and I understand that he installed it in so many different ways, right? Including once in a long line, and they were also pieces taken out and put back in. So this kind of possibility of exchange. Uh-huh. And then the ultimate frustration of like, ooh, is that weird blue thing a toilet? And I want to see the other side of it. And, you know, the sight lines always, you can see everything, but it's difficult. So yeah. there's a lot of great frustration built into that piece that I like in terms of this, the way it's arranged, not with space, but with...
Yeah, salon style hanging of sculpture. Yeah.
Petersburg.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard to choose favorite, and it. But I like. I thought that the exhibition showed really well how this figurative aspect of Martin's work, an abstract aspect, how delicate a balance that is, emotionally that you are as a viewer to these works. So there was one wall that had three large paintings. I'd say probably about 5 foot by 4 foot, and. One looks kind of like a beige or a light kind of shell or something, but has extreme violence in these paintings. And the titles, I don't know what the title is, but the violence was very, very moving to me. I love the self-portraits. You know, I love the one that I had, but the one where the gentleman's sitting there just with the blue there and kind of the beige box in front of the underwear, I think it's amazing. But I think that the ending the show, the self-portrait, the orange self-portrait with the three-dimensional eyes.
Goopy eyes, yeah.
The color is unbelievable. It's so beautifully painted and profound. I mean, just, you know, you think of a great Picasso portrait, but I was very, very moved by it. I thought it was just beautiful.
Friedrich, a favorite, can you?
I stay with the whole Peter.
Oh, you're in the Peter, right, exactly, yeah.
Could I leap into the discussion of the Peter exhibition? We talked a little bit about this previous to coming on stage, but in 1987, I happened to wander into the installation of the Peter exhibition, not knowing who Martin Kippenberger was, and it was one of the memorable moments for me because I didn't know at all how to respond, what to think. The exhibition really stopped me in my tracks. And, you know, those are rare and important occasions when that sort of event occurs. So in the installation of the Peter exhibition, as it was produced in 1987, one could wander through all the sculptures, those kind of ridiculous banana peels that were cast in resin, kind of form, you know, almost like a little route through the exhibition. And it was, you know, one of those moments where I kept waiting for it to make sense, and it never really congealed. And, you know, it remained open, which kept bringing me back to it and back to it. And so my question that I was very interested to address to you tonight was to know something about the translation of that work from the open and much more chaotic feel of the installation at Hetzler's when it was originally produced, and then how it ended up in this much more tidy configuration here. And if you could just talk a little bit about how you confronted that, how Ann Goldstein, the curator in Los Angeles, confronted that, and was that something that he provided for, or was it made up?
And the answer to the Peter sculpture question really stands as well for the Kafka's America, which is that these are works that had multiple presentations during the course of Kippenberger's life, on which he worked closely with assistants, and were near enough in date to the point when they were originally made that those same assistants are the ones who are at this point installing them wherever they're shown. But it's a very good question, and it goes back to sculptures from the 60s, certainly, and if not earlier, of when you have work that is either random or is possibly flexible in nature in terms of bits and pieces or parts that can be put together in different ways. You know, are you? There's a whole spectrum from an artist absolutely dictating to leaving no word at all, and are you better off? Where do you locate yourself as installers in the future? And with Kippenberger, you know, that question, it won't be that long before we aren't there with the people who were there firsthand. And how much the kind of freedom that Kippenberger gave himself is something that a curator can take on or an owner, private owner, can take on, and how much at a certain point you just want to repeat what was done will become a big question. Do you have a point of view, Friedrich, on that from having done?
I just remember the confinement, the way the space was configured at Max Hetzler's gallery in 1987 at the Comica Straße. That was it. I mean, there was just not more space there. Now at the Modern, you can't just replicate that. So to some extent, it is tidier. It's tidy. It looks tidy. But then you have all these kinds of lender questions and so on. They don't want this to be probably presented in some corner.
Well, I mean, the big difference, of course, is that you can't walk through it. Same with Kafka.
Exactly.
So right off the bat,
it
becomes a unit in a way that it wasn't, which is the same thing of many Joseph Beuys's or Robert Morris's
Sure.
You know, there is this inevitable freezing in some way.
There's one interesting aspect in terms of the looseness, how we started the conversation about looseness.
The
Peter sculptures and so far, this was the first time in sculpture where he gave up. He didn't give up control, really, but he kind of enabled someone else to execute the sculpture according to his drawings. But they were not even drawings. They were sketches. And
Are they all his? Aren't some of the drawings Michael Kreber's drawings?
the drawings, have, if I recall, they are Kippenberger drawings, but Kreber had to interpret this. So he stood there, and I mean, they're really not much. They don't give you much detail, for example. So Martin actually let him do it. He always said, like, if anybody can interpret my work, it's Kreber. And so this is one of the other confusing elements. No, in some way, they're very controlled because this is what he had to work with. He couldn't interpret that much more. This is what it was. No, this drawing, this sketch you have to work with. But then the bottle of water that's standing in one of these sculptures, that he could interpret. He could, so it's this funny, fine line. No, in the early days, he also asked some guy to execute some of the paintings, but in sculpture, he had never, to my knowledge, he never did that before. So Peter was a turning point.
Are you talking about when he had Merlin Carpenter?
That's later.
Make Martin Kippenberger paintings?
That was then
the
later
sign,
again.
The sign painters.
No, in 1977, if I'm not mistaken. Or 1980, I don't remember.
79.
He had the sign painter make the first room in the show. Execute those.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. No, last sorry, thing, sorry, and then we'll open it up.
Any installation situation, you know, the artist always is responding to that architecture. And if Martin was making an exhibition, a certain gallery, maybe there's windows in the front here, so maybe what you would choose to put there would have a psychologically different feeling than putting another work there. So these things are always in play to a certain degree to the architecture that they're going in, and the decisions that he could have made for a particular situation were just due to, you know, that specific situation, which now is different. You know.
Yeah. Questions? Yes?
This question is specifically for Mr. Coombs, but I'd like to hear from any of you. With reference to your own art making, could you comment on the Dear Painter, Paint for Me series and what you think that has to do with the idea of authorship of the artist?
As they were just speaking, you know, Martin always worked with a lot of people and worked with different artists. I guess it also just has to do with a kind of a sense of performing, of being a performer and kind of meeting the need that anybody is requesting of you very eagerly, kind of making a pun on that in some way. I don't know how else to respond. I like those paintings. I think they're beautiful paintings.
Anyone else on that?
I like those paintings too.
Another question,
because we've been sort of talking about his energy and the way he worked with other people, that the kind of collaborative spirit, and then also the concept behind it being a kind of provocation, right? And that I think he wanted his works to be provocative, and this was another way of sort of exploring that emotional communication that way.
To keep everything in play all the time is such an exhausting activity. I mean, you can imagine the energy that Martin had to carry with him to just every moment keep everything in play, that everything's usable and adaptable and right into the vocabulary and can be articulated and aestheticized, that it functions within the vocabulary. Tremendous energy.
Yeah.
You talk of Martin as being uncensored, but also pragmatic. I think those were two words that were used to describe him. And I'm wondering, with that sort of juxtaposition, like, to what degree did he define his audience when he was working? Like, did he think about a particular audience, or was it all kind of very reactionary? Or was there that sort of, like, I know this is going to work, and I know who's going to really love this, and I'm going to make this, and or was it very much like, this is what I'm thinking today, or both? And yeah, if he had an idea of his audience.
I think he didn't have any particular audience outside his inner circle in front of him, if I may say so. I think a lot of these works came out of a particular spirit amongst his friends, and it has a little bit to do with, like, almost like sports. Like, how do you undermine a situation? How do you tell a joke much, much better than someone else? How can you undermine someone else's presumption? So this was like, sometimes there's a group of, I don't know, five or six people, and how can I outsmart one of my best friends? How can I be better than? such and such. But he didn't think of some abstract audience. He's not doing a show for New York, or he's not doing an exhibition for a particular audience in Sweden or so.
Yeah, and then maybe the project, to extend that idea, I agree that this project in Greece, it was really for the artists who were invited,
exactly.
Right? So if he invited Christopher Williams to do a film screening, and then, there were three artists there to watch it that he had invited to do other projects.
Yeah.
It was, I think, the camaraderie of the friends and the kind of social exchange of his peer group and the artists around him. But maybe part of his ambition, which has been discussed a lot too, would have been for a larger audience, right? So that also the legend he was creating of himself, as he created this myth about himself, it would extend out into the world in a very heroic fashion, maybe. That,
maybe an antagonistic fashion as well. Yeah. I mean, he was infamous for, as you referred to, earlier, a lot of theatricality at dinner parties. And after parties and that sort of thing. And I never had the sense that he was attempting to appeal to a particular audience. I think that the social base of the work was camaraderie. And so certainly, working with his pals and these, different kinds of gangs of friends almost was really at the core of the social dimension of the work. I think there is a self-consciousness in the work about, perhaps we might call it a kind of inside jokes or something of that nature. And there were certain people who understood the references and then, huge audiences who had to grope towards some sort of relevancy or meaning in the remarks in the work. But that's kind of what we're all doing now and will do into perpetuity in terms of unpacking the work, I think.
I want to add also one more thing because I lived in Cologne during the 80s. He was not successful. I mean, he had a peer group of artist friends and some collectors, but there was no institutional backup for his practice. There were many other artists who were way more successful than he was. And I think he always worked out of that kind of feeling of being deprived or so of some certain success. I mean, that kind of was kind of a modus operandi to some extent.
No, and it's still stunning, really, how few of the loans to this exhibition are from institutions.
Yeah.
It's still not work that you find in public collections very much.
Yeah. But because everything is a bit distorted now, people think like he was like this kind of demigod in Germany. He was not at all. They despised him. I mean, the press was unbelievable. And we had to look at this like every other week when you got a review of our shows. They were not even...
Less than favorable?
Less than favorable.
Last question.
Was he able to articulate, or was he interested at all in articulating what he was trying to accomplish? Or did he step back from his work and was he able to talk about what he was doing? Or was he just playing all the time and leaving it up to the art world to decide what it was about?
He was not, if you ask me, he was not an intellectual who gave you like the kind of the paragraph of some kind of an interpretation with the work or so. Quite the opposite. He was more interested in actually kind of provoking a certain response that he could not control. By that token, I don't want to sound as if he was some kind of like artiste maudit or some kind of crazy man or so. Quite the opposite. Like we talked about it before, his work is quite controlled, and he knew exactly what he was doing. But he could not control the audience, and he didn't wish so. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
That's good.
When we were speaking before about Martin's kind of intentions or the mass aspect, I mean, as an artist, I always thought that, Martin was, really ambitious. So maybe just coming from the artistic point of view, because, he wanted to participate in this dialogue and competitive, but in a positive way. It's a life energy type of interest in the activity, but very ambitious. So I always saw it as having a much wider type of mass because I could feel the profoundness kind of its force. So I see it as having more of a kind of a defined and his ability to define and to control, you know.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, speaker. Thank you for coming tonight.